stop and take a breath and think for just a second, how often do you have to think about breathing? Most of us are lucky and we get the proper amount of air when we need it, but forces inside and outside our bodies can put some stress on the breathing mechanism. Our first guest studies those forces from high altitude on Earth to unusual gas mixes aboard the International Space Station. Andrew Andy Lovering is an associate professor in the Department of Human Physiology at the University of Oregon, where he's the head of the Cardiopulmonary and Respiratory Physiology Lab. And he's our guest in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio, our joint project with the University of Oregon. Andy Lovering, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm fascinated by the fact you don't really do clinical work. I mean, you're not like in the process of healing people so much as just watching what happens to them when stuff goes on.
Yeah, well, we do dabble a little bit in the clinical world, mostly through our collaborations with clinicians at the local hospitals here. But we also do a lot, as you mentioned, we also do quite a bit of work with relatively healthy humans with some rather extreme environmental challenges, such as high altitude or in space.
Well, it seems like if there's any part of the body we do take for granted, it's the breathing apparatus. I mean, breathe in, breathe out, repeat. How complicated or not is the mechanism and structures?
I would say for most people, breathing is, as you said, relatively easy to do, and people don't even have to think about it. And when I talk to my students in class, I usually have to remind them that they're actually breathing during class because they don't have to think about it. But for people that have damaged airways, either from smoking or the individuals that we tend to study most often, those kids that are born extremely premature whose airways don't develop normally, they tend to have a greater work of breathing or more difficulty breathing, especially during challenges such as exercise.
So let's go there first, because it sounds like this is an ongoing bit of research looking at the long-term effects on breathing for people born at low birth weights. Is there a clear line of weight as an indicator here?
No, that's a great question. When I will say that usually when we study our subjects, we're looking more for them being just preterm or extremely preterm. So looking at moderate to late preterm, which is 32 to 37 weeks, very preterm, which is 28 to 32 weeks, and then extremely preterm, less than 28 weeks. I don't have any of the numbers directly on top of my head. I apologize for the birth weight information.
But what are some of the general effects you see?
Some of the general effects that we've seen in our lab and in other labs throughout the world have been most of these individuals, as I mentioned, have worse lung function compared to their age-matched controls. They tend to have lower exercise capacity, either measured with a VO2 max test or looking at some other index of exercise. People are just now starting to at least publish some data looking at cardiac structure and function, showing that their hearts seem to be a little bit different, a little bit smaller chambers, a little bit thicker walls. And we are just now publishing some work showing that they may have exercise-induced pulmonary hypertension as well.
So, you know, I've read plenty over the years about how inelastic the lungs are in underdeveloped babies. I mean, do the body structures ever catch up? Is that part of the issue here? They don't?
Yes, that's correct. It doesn't appear that there's any real catch-up growth, such that if you make some comparisons early in life and then look at this throughout their development, yeah, even when they're full-grown adults, 18 to 20 and older, they still have lower lung function values compared to their term controls.
That would seem to indicate then some potential restrictions on activities through their lives.
That's definitely correct. And what's really not known is what are the longer term outcomes for these individuals, because the oldest kids with that have survived to this age are around 40 to 50 years old right now.
And are you seeing some fairly consistent things about the people in that age bracket about the kinds of things they've been able to do or not through their lives?
The 40 and 50 year olds,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's really not a lot published on in groups that old. Unfortunately, that's most of the newer work coming out now is in the early teens to mid-20s, looking at cohorts that they followed up over this time. So there's not a lot of information on the 40 to 50 year olds, but I suspect that will be coming with these cohort studies.
I was reading in some of your research, Andy, about the use of the gas Heliox for some of the people with the underdeveloped people who were born prematurely, low birth weight children. What is Heliox, and what kind of results have you noticed with it?
Yeah, so Heliox is just a mixture between helium and oxygen, and you can mix it to any in any level. So you can make it a hyperoxic or a high oxygen mix with Heliox, or a normal oxygen mix with Heliox. And the idea is that helium is a lower density gas and makes it easier for people to breathe. So if you give somebody some helium, then or give somebody a helium oxygen mixture, it allows them to reduce their work of breathing and exercise for longer periods of time.
This is what's done still with deep sea divers, isn't it? A more helium rich mixture.
Right. So the individuals using the tri-mix or the different mixtures of gases, the reason that they do this is to at great depths, it increases the density of gases. So they try to use mixes which reduce the density, make it easier to breathe. That's correct.
We're taking a journey into the lungs today on our Curious segment, our research segment with the University of Oregon. Andy Loverings, an associate professor in the Department of Human Physiology and the head of the Cardiopulmonary and Respiratory Physiology Lab. You can join our conversation on the exchange. Maybe you have some questions about lung function or breathing mechanisms and how all that stuff works together and what some of the stresses can be. We'd love to hear from you at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about your high altitude studies in Bolivia. It sounds like you went up the mountain, down the mountain, up the mountain again. What were you trying to find there? How did you lay out the study?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we did. We went up the mountain and down the mountain and up the mountain again. Those studies were designed to investigate some of the possible causes of high altitude illness, specifically acute mountain sickness or AMS. And we did this work in collaboration with our colleagues at the University of Colorado in Denver and Colorado Springs. And the idea was to take a group of relatively healthy young individuals who hadn't lived at high altitude before. So that's why we chose individuals living in Eugene, Oregon. And then we flew them to Bolivia and took them up to high altitude on supplemental oxygen and up to the top of Mount Chocolataya, which is about 17,000 feet. And then we studied them acutely and then over the course of acclimatization for about 16 days. And then, as you mentioned, when we took them back down to about 5,000 feet, we let them stay there somewhere between 7 and 21 days. And then we would take them back up to the mountain to see how much of the acclimatization that they had retained after being at a lower altitude for, 7 to 21 days.
And were they any better off when they went back the second time?
The ones that were only down for 7 days did just as well as they had at the end of the 16 days of acclimatization, but the ones that were down for 21 days were not able to retain any of that acclimatization.
Interesting. I've often wondered about the whole concept of acclimatization, not just for the atmosphere, but just how you get used to hot and cold and stuff like that. Are there specific things that you can point to now, particularly in the lungs, that go on that are the acclimatization, that represent the actual physical structures of acclimatization?
So one of the things that we found from our lab on this topic was that we screened our subjects before they went to high altitude to see if they had a small cardiac shunt called a patent foraminal valley.
Mm-hmm.
And about half of our subjects had a patent foraminal valley or PFO, and the other half did not. And we found that the subjects with the hole in their heart did not do as well at high altitude as the ones without the hole in their heart. And the idea, and I should mention that this small hole in the heart is present in about a third of the general population, so about one in three people have it, and the hole can be varying sizes, either very, very tiny or relatively large.
Interesting.
And we found that these individuals with the hole in their heart had worse gas exchange efficiency at the end of the acclimatization period. And also, really surprising to us, they had a blunted ventilatory acclimatization. So they didn't acclimatize as well as the subjects without the hole in the heart.
So, simply put, what causes acute mountain sickness? I mean, is it just you're not getting enough air in?
It's not necessarily that you're not getting enough air in. It has to do with the level of hypoxia that the brain is seeing. Most people believe that acute mountain sickness is primarily a cerebral phenomenon. So people have high altitude headache, nausea, you know, this kind of thing.
So it is. It's all about the brain then. It's just the lack of oxygen getting to the brain itself. The other body structures are like, eh, but the brain is the one that's really getting annoyed about this.
Right. The brain is pretty sensitive to hypoxia. That's correct.
Andy Lovering's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange on our research segment called Curious Research Meets Radio. He is an associate professor in the Department of Human Physiology, and he is the head of the Cardiopulmonary and Respiratory Physiology Lab at the U of O. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org if you want to join us. So do people not used to high elevations eventually get acclimated, or is it just some of them just barred from ever really quite getting there?
For as far as the individuals we studied that have the Peyton-Framino Valley, we only studied them for 16 days. So that's a great question. We don't know if we left them there for another week, would they catch up to the ones without the hole in their heart? We don't know if they're always going to have some level of lower acclimatization. It's definitely something we'd like to follow up on.
You said as a third of the population has the small hole in the heart. Is it something we should be concerned about? Should we see our doctors? Is it worth knowing that we have it?
That's a really good question. I think there's an ongoing debate about that in the literature and within the scientific community.
All right. So.
I think there are definitely some associations with a PFO and other health-related problems outside of altitude, including migraines, strokes, this kind of thing. And I believe that there is also the idea that people who have this small hole in their heart may be more susceptible to other high-altitude illnesses, such as high-altitude pulmonary edema.
So before we leave the Earth, I want to bring in another variable here, which is humidity. And then I can recall steamy days when I lived in the East Coast that it just felt like it was hard to get enough air going on there. Can high humidities reduce the amount of oxygen you're getting in?
I would say at sea level, probably not going to reduce the amount of oxygen that you're getting in. It may feel like you're having a greater sensation of breathlessness or dyspnea, but at sea level, it shouldn't impact. For normal healthy people, it shouldn't impact the amount of oxygen they can get in.
Okay. The way I read the original question was, is it just me freaking out or something to that? Well, it's just me freaking out.
Yeah. I won't say anything.
Okay. So take us off planet now. It sounds like NASA did fund some of your most recent work. Tell us about the work with the space station.
Yeah, so the work that we're doing related to the space station are on ground-based with what they would call analog studies. So we're looking at the impact of it's a 30-day bed rest study where subjects are on a bed with their head tilted down to mimic the fluid shifts that they would have if they were in microgravity. And the novel component to this study that just finished up a few days ago is the addition of a higher ambient carbon dioxide level. So this is a higher levels of CO2 because the NASA is concerned about the possibility that high levels of CO2 on the space station could cause problems. So we're investigating some of that on the Earth right now. And we have found that after 30 days of during this bed rest study, we looked at individuals' breathing responses to carbon dioxide, and it seems to be over the 30 days of these studies, their breathing responses were a little bit blunted or not quite as strong as they were when they started the study.
How much more CO2 are they getting than what's normally in the atmosphere?
So the in the normal atmosphere, there's almost no CO2 in the normal atmosphere that we breathe. But in this study, they increased it by about half of a percent. So relatively small amount of CO2.
Wow. So we're fairly sensitive then to more CO2.
Just mild. Yeah. This half a percent was what we would consider to be very mild levels of CO2. But the NASA wanted to be, and rightfully so, wanted to be a little cautious and not give too much of a too large of a hammer initially to do when we started just starting these studies. So I think maybe moving forward they can try to bump up the level of CO2 to see how that impacts all the variables that were measured on this study.
So I hadn't thought about the fact we're trying to create something like the atmosphere on the space station. I don't know much about it. I mean, first of all, do they have machinery there that does create oxygen from some other process? And then what is the atmosphere like? Is it meant to be like Earth? Is it meant to be more oxygen rich than what we have on the Earth? Is it pressurized to 10,000 feet or something?
Yeah, those are all good questions, and I will tell you I don't know the exact answer to the level of pressurization and what it's supposed to be. I believe they try to maintain relatively normal oxygen conditions, and there are pieces of equipment that are designed to filter the air and take out the expired carbon dioxide that our bodies produce, so they don't want CO2 or carbon dioxide building up on the space station. That's for certain. So they do have machinery designed to scrub that, but the exact oxygen level and the exact pressure, I couldn't tell you.
So this bed rest study sounds like it took a special kind of person to take part. I mean, did they have to stay in bed the whole time, the whole 30 days?
Yeah. These bed rest studies are there's some real superheroes, I think, for the people that participate in these. And this, they were required to be in bed the entire 30 days with their head tilted down slightly, so that the feels like the blood is kind of pooling at their head instead of at their feet.
Could they read? Could they watch TV? Could they do? I mean, they had to eat in these positions too.
Yes, they did everything in this position, including some of the breathing tests that we did on them while they were in there. And I do know that as you mentioned, it does require a relatively special kind of person. And the group that we're working with, the study's actually being done in Cologne, Germany, through the German Aerospace Center, or the DLR. In chatting with them, I think they told me that they spent approximately 120,000 euros going through the screening process to select the 12 subjects that were initially involved in this study.
Wow, so that suggests a very lengthy search for the people who were the final 12.
Yes, that's correct.
So do you have some recommendations back to NASA then for things to consider?
I know that they're doing all they can to scrub the CO2 out of the atmosphere on the space station, and it is known that people who have obstructive lung disease, who have high levels of CO2 in their blood because they don't breathe as well because of their lung damage, we know that these individuals tend to have a blunted response to CO2 as well. I think what's surprising me so far, and again, these data are all preliminary, none of this is published yet. I think what's surprising me is that such a mild level of CO2 is causing a similar phenomenon in a relatively short period of time. I was surprised. I think about midway through the study when we started to see these blunted CO2 responses.
So that's interesting. So we are that sensitive to CO2. Did NASA request the studies on Earth because they were having some issues on the space station, people with altered perceptions or just getting cranky in the morning or what?
No, the study design was actually another great question. The entire study design was determined by NASA. So it's interesting for us to be part of a study where we didn't have a whole lot of input into the design of the study. The idea or the what NASA is really interested in is looking at trying to determine if the high CO2 has any role in a visual impairment, intracranial pressure syndrome that they've been studying, that they think may be involved in some of the visual acuity complaints that the astronauts and cosmonauts have.
Okay, so they're just things aren't looking quite right up there. They don't have eye doctors in space either, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that, again, I'm not sure. I don't think everybody on the space station is an eye doctor for sure. That's probably safe to say.
How unusual is that though to have somebody else hand you the parameters and say, "Here, study this."
For me, it was my first time to be involved in a study like this, where I was told, "Here's what's going to happen." You know, basically, what can you study within these constraints and within this experimental paradigm?
We're talking to Andy Lovering at the University of Oregon. He's the head of the Cardiopulmonary and Respiratory Physiology Lab. Off-air question from Peter in Ashland wants to know if there are any benefits to the lungs for being raised at high altitude, 7,000 feet or more.
That's a great question. I think there's a bit of literature that's been done in some animal studies showing that if you take a group of animals or a litter of dogs or something like this and raise one at low altitude and one at high altitude, the ones at high altitude tend to have larger lung volumes, and I think I think some of the altitude native studies would show the same thing.
Okay, so it can happen in people too. Let's before we go, I want to talk about in case people are thinking, well, my lungs feel great today, I'll go out for some exercise. You have also studied something called exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage. Ouch! What's that?
Admittedly, this is something that we haven't studied directly. We have some looking at these preterm subjects. So these are individuals who are born at 28 weeks or less. And they, when they grow up, we study them as adults, and we've noticed that they have higher pulmonary pressures during exercise than their age-matched term controls. And it is known that there are some humans that have exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage, but it's not really well understood why some of these humans bleed from their lungs after they exercise. And it's a relatively rare rare problem.
Always lots to look for in the lungs and the breathing mechanism generally. Andy Lovering is on top of it with his crew at the head of the Cardiopulmonary and Respiratory Physiology Lab at the University of Oregon. Andy is an associate professor in the Department of Human Physiology. He's been our guest in Curious Research Meets Radio. Andy, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.